Hey Tim, how are you?
Good, Noam. Thank you for doing Blogging Heads with me today.
Yeah, well, likewise. Looking forward to it. So why don't we introduce ourselves? I'm Noam Scheiber. I'm a staff writer at the New Republic magazine.
I'm Tim Carney. I am a senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner.
Terrific. So what's going on these days? I guess there's some kind of tax cut deal that looks like it's pending in Congress.
You say tax cut, I say tax hike averted. The Obama deal surely has upset some people on the left. I just wish, you know, we had gotten the tax hikes permanently forestalled. I was surprised because, and this is how bad a tactician I am, a couple weeks ago I thought there's no way Republicans are going to win this fight, because you had John Boehner going ahead and saying, look, if I have a choice between tax hikes on everybody or tax hikes just on the rich, I'll take tax hikes just on the rich to avoid taxing hikes on everybody else. Boehner said that on television.
Yeah.
And I just thought that the rhetorical line the Republicans had that the Democrats had was a winner. Are you really going to hold hostage the tax hikes on average Americans in order to save tax hikes for the rich? I thought that was a rhetorical winner. I guess I was wrong. I guess it's a good thing I'm not a party floor leader.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's what a lot of people on the left are sort of wondering. It did seem to be a rhetorical winner, as you say. I mean, Obama gave this pretty – the one time Obama waded into the discussion during the campaign was that September 8th speech in Cleveland, where he talked about holding tax cuts hostage, holding middle class tax cuts hostage for the upper income increases. Mm-hmm. And as you say, Boehner crumpled like immediately. I thought they had the rhetorical, political, and personally, I thought they had the substantive high ground here. And I thought it was pretty mystifying that they didn't actually prosecute that, you know, press that advantage. A couple of thoughts. I mean, so I personally think the time to do this would have been during the campaign, you know, spring, summer, mm-hmm. whenever, to really mount a rhetorical offensive on this stuff. And as the Boehner episode showed, I think the Republicans would have folded, knowing that the politics were not really favorable, which is why they, you know, had connected the upper income and middle class cuts in the mm-hmm. first place to, you know, to expand the base of popularity for these things. So I really thought the time to do that was then. I have a piece we just posted today, and it, you know, it turns out there was kind of a split within the administration. The wonks, the policy people, thought that the advantages were actually overwhelming to doing this soon, you know, during the campaign, even back in mm-hmm. the spring. And the political people just thought it was kind of a mess. They worried a bit about the tax cut, you know, the tax raiser argument being deployed against them, kind of the way it was against Kerry and Gore in the previous cycles. And, you know, the policy people, even though they all wanted kind of immediate action, they all had slight variations on sort of what they thought was the ideal version. You know, some people thought, you know, maybe she'll only make the middle class cuts temporary too, you know, not mm-hmm. just make them permanent and make the upper incomes expire, because we're going to have this deficit, you know, we got this long-term deficit issue. So there were some differences among the policy people that I think caused the political people, you know, between that and the, you know, just the kind of lack of backbone of Democrats on the Hill, caused them to say, you know, this is a mess. We don't want to deal with it now. Let's punt it after the election.
Well, and part of it, I wonder if part of it is that really – politically, I know I've seen polls on this, but I'm just not convinced that most people want, or at least have passion for, higher taxes on the rich. And part of it was confusing to some people who say, well, there's certainly a populist element mm-hmm. to the Tea mm-hmm. Party and what went on, mm-hmm. but it might be my kind of populism. In other words, mm-hmm. people got upset about the bailouts, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean they're going to get upset about people making $300,000 only paying 35% on their marginal tax rates. In other words, that you can – part of – Americans are sort of aspirational. We sort of mm-hmm. see the rich as people will be. I hope to be rich in 10 years. Uh-huh. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility. I don't think it's likely, but
right.
I think a lot of Americans feel that way. And so you can get upset about my money being taken and given to a right. Goldman Sachs banker while not being upset about the Goldman Sachs banker getting to keep, you know, at least 65% keep from the federal government, at least 65% of what he makes. Right. And so, go on.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, that was one of the anxieties at work. But I think, you know, this is where you just have to understand that the president has just, far and away the biggest megaphone always. Bush, mm-hmm. Showed that in passing the tax cuts in the first place. And, you know, there are just a series of rhetorical frames that I think are very effective. I think you're right. In the abstract, people aren't that exercised about rich people being taxed less. What they are upset about is, okay, well, you know, because of the deficit situation, if we don't raise taxes on the rich, we're going to have to cut from, you know, Medicare. We're going to have to cut from...
Do you believe that?
Set aside my substance view. I'm just saying, rhetorically, even if you think people aren't that exercised about rich people's taxes going up in the abstract, there are a variety of ways that to get them exercised about it, and they will be exercised. You know, if you're basically
saying we have
limited resources, and we can do a variety of things you don't like cutting these services, or we can do one thing that you don't care about, which is raise taxes on rich people. Then I think, or we can say, look. Another rhetorical frame would have been, look, we don't have a ton of money. It's either your taxes or the rich people's taxes.
I'd love it if we had to have balanced budgets, but we don't have to have balanced budgets. And so politically, there isn't that trade-off. That's why you can do stimulus without saying we're asking people to make a sacrifice in order to stimulate. And that's why Republicans can say, well, we're going to have to give up government programs in order to cut your taxes, because both parties they tap into the national debt. And so
right.
there isn't this need. I would love a fight over Democratic spending proposals. If every time the Democrats wanted to hike spending, or Republican porkers for that matter, they had to raise taxes or cut somewhere else. I would love to have that fight.
Right. Well, look,
I think my side would win.
There's an important short-term, long-term dynamic here. And the argument is, look, clearly, long term, we've got to rein in the debt and the deficit. There's just there's no question about that. Short term, the Democratic argument is, you know, it's going to be more costly if the economy isn't growing over the long term. So we want to do some short term stimulus and then rein in the debt, the deficit over the long term. And the argument about the tax cuts was permanent means long term. So we can, you know, over 10 years, obviously the upper income cuts would have been $700 billion. You know, if you're saying, look, we've got to get this long term deficit under control, and it's $700 billion for upper income tax cuts, or $700 billion that's got to come out of Social Security, I think it's a pretty overwhelmingly strong political argument.
Let's shift from the politics to the substance, if you don't mind. What I always ask liberals is, say, what's the appropriate tax rate on the rich, or what's the appropriate ratio between what the highest rates and the lowest rates are? Because part of my problem, I mean, I don't like the existence of an income tax in the first place. Mm-hmm. Given an income tax, I don't object to it being progressive. Once you have a standard deduction or a personal exemption in there, it automatically has some progressivity built into it. So given a progressive tax code, I'll say, fine, let's freeze it in place so that the ratio in place doesn't have to be flat.
Right.
But I don't want you constantly jiggering around this rate, that rate, and being able to class warfare every time. I mean, Bush made the income tax code more progressive. And from that, now the Democratic
he did that he lowered taxes on kind of the working
the
poor,
tax
basically.
The tax cuts on the poor and the middle class were at, especially when you consider the marriage penalty cuts, were a higher percentage of their taxes got lopped off than the percentage of the Democrats.
That's true,
taxes.
But without the dividend income, capital gains.
Okay, yes.
Estate taxes are important pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah. But so my point is that the income tax keeps getting more progressive, and then the Democrats keep saying, well, we're going to make it even more progressive, and if you resist us, you're just trying to give money to rich people.
Right.
So my point is, okay, fine, make it 4-1, that the top rate is always 4 times the bottom rate,
right.
And every time you have to raise taxes or lower taxes, we do it proportionally, so that if you 10% cut, 40% goes down to 36, 10% goes down to 9, everybody's taxes would go down 10. If we need more money, everybody's goes up 10.
Right.
But, I mean, is that palatable? I've never heard a liberal say, okay, I'll settle for that.
It
seems they always want to have the lever of taxing the rich more.
Right. That's not a bad thought. I would say a couple things. One, I don't have strong abstract ideas about this, but the Clinton rate seemed great to me. You know, the economy was doing well. I don't think the rich people were oppressed by paying 39.6 on the top marginal rate rather than 35, 36. So those seem fine to me. Two, I think that I'm happy with fixing ratios, but I think we need way more brackets, not fewer. Income inequality has massively increased since
the
70s.
So right now the top bracket is at 370-something thousand.
So I think the top bracket should be at 100 million, maybe 500 million. So I think 100 millionaires should be taxed at a much higher rate, or the income that you make above 100 million should be taxed at a much higher rate. I'd put one at 100 million. I put one at 100 million, one at 10 million, one at a million. Income inequality has dramatically shot up since the 70s, particularly in the top 1%. And it's crazy that a billionaire pays the same marginal rate on his billionth and first dollar that a dentist pays on his first, you know, on his 250,000, you know, or 331,000th dollar. I'm stealing this idea from James Surowiecki from The New Yorker, but I think it's terrific. And it reflects the distribution of income. I mean, the tax structure we have now reflects a distribution of income that's a generation or two out of date. So I would be happy to fix the ratios in place if we could, A, you know, account for the current skew of income, and B, have it continue to account for that skew. I mean, if income inequality got way worse, then we would want to maybe add another bracket or two. Conversely, if we had a massive narrowing of income inequality, when we looked a little more like we did in the 60s, then I'd be happy to get rid of the, you know, the upper one.
But so you wouldn't even need to do it in our little structure here. You could have brackets that don't hit anybody. In other
right,
words,
yeah,
you
right.
could set your billion-dollar bracket and have a you know, an index for inflation, and if people are zooming past there,
right.
have that go too. And that's the kind of idea that, again, I don't like the existence of an income tax. Mm-hmm. Given an income tax, I don't exactly know theoretically how to set up the progressivity and stuff, but the idea, again, I know people as married couples make almost $400,000 and they live comfortably, but they're not
right.
obscenely
right.
rich. And
right, right.
you
right.
multiply
no.
that by three, you're
right.
significantly, each dollar is
yeah.
worth not as much to you
yeah.
as
Agreed.
It was to the, yeah.
No, I'd be ready to make this deal today, so we can get this done.
All right, good.
One other question for you on the tax debt politics, mm-hmm. though, and this is just you know, you're much in a much better position to answer this question than I am. What you know, you have this dynamic, and I think you're right. I think Republicans got a better deal because I just think Democrats the White House made an offensive on this in the summer. Clearly,
mm-hmm.
Republicans would have folded. I just don't see them holding out against this argument, but. That said, the place where we found ourselves in the last week or two, you know, hurtling toward this January 1st reset of the rates,
mm-hmm.
I did think by that point the White House was in a bit of a bind. I still think they should have probably fought rhetorically, but I understand their decision not to. They, you know, when you're president, rates go up, it's tricky, right? So I thought, you know, by this point, the lame duck period, they had lost a lot of leverage. And I was actually a bit surprised that they got as much as they did, given the place where they found themselves.
Yes.
Again, not resetting the beginning of the year, but just lame duck where they found themselves with not a lot of leverage. I was surprised that they got the 13 months of unemployment, the payroll tax cut, the extension of all their tax credits in exchange for the two-year extension. And
most of the tax credits.
Most of the tax credits, yeah. And I guess I'm curious as to your thought as to why, you know, Republicans agreed to that stuff. I mean, I think they
mm-hmm.
could have maybe pressed their case even a little more, particularly when they have, you know, like a Tea Party flank that's probably not super excited about 13 months
the
of
tea
unemployment.
Party, the Tea Party flank wasn't in the room.
Right. Well, that's
I mean,
true. But
this
they
is the thing. And
there's always a potential primary challenger
yeah.
looming over you, right, if you're John
sure.
Boehner or Mitch McConnell.
No, and we'll get to your story about business later on. But you acknowledge, although I don't think you get the texture right, you acknowledge kind of a difference between a Tea Party wing and a more Chamber of Commerce wing.
Right.
I call
right.
it the K Street wing and the Tea Party wing.
Sure.
The K Street wing doesn't care like, you know, Jim Bunning or Tom Coburn about paying for things.
Right. Right.
They're more motivated towards, basically winning and having power is the way I would put it. And so tax cuts are very important politically in an acute, measurable way. and winning over those, winning over the tax cuts was what mattered, and going ahead and making sure you're paying for this stuff. That's what a DeMint would have demanded. Coburn's says he's going to support this deal, but if he had been in the room, he would have wanted more pay-fors, probably. Yeah. You know, you get Mike Lee or Rand Paul in the room,
right.
They wouldn't have agreed to this deal. So I think that's part of why the Democrats got what they did, because they got stuff that the party leadership, the more strictly political operatives there, that they don't see it as a loser. It doesn't turn off the Republican base to extend unemployment.
Right. But see, here's like my thing. Here's my thing. Just in pure brass tacks political terms, the problem I see for the Republican leadership in agreeing to this deal is you extend the unemployment benefits, you do the payroll tax thing. I mean, you basically agreed to a couple hundred billion dollars in stimulus, right? Mm-hmm. And that stimulus helps Obama because it's going to help the economy. I mean, maybe you just don't believe that, but I think it's reasonable to assume that that stuff helps politically and then economically, which then helps politically. If you were a devious Republican leader, which Mitch McConnell clearly is, why would you not want to deprive him of that stuff, hope the economy stays bad, which hurts his reelection chances and furthers your goal of making him a one-term president?
This is the evil genius idea, and I've seen Iglesias lay it out a couple times, a bit of it in your piece, that, well, we want to, this was sort of a Lenin idea, the worse the better. We want to blow things up so that the economy is worse. I don't buy that any of that goes on. I don't buy the Keynesian arguments, and I don't think Mitch McConnell does either.
You just think he doesn't think this is going to matter.
The Occam's razor explanation of this is, yes, Republicans, especially you look at the party leadership, their main goal is to get a Senate majority, keep a House majority, and win the White House in 2012. That's more important than almost any policy goals. Democrats are analogous, except being in the majority, the policy and the politics are more closely linked. But it's this idea that, you know, conservatives have these ideas about liberals and liberals have these ideas about conservatives. So it's always, the other side is strategically better. This is some self-serving excuse that both sides give in order to explain why they ever lose. They're more cutthroat. They're willing to do this.
Right.
And you see conservatives talking about, Obama wanted to lose the House because it helps him hold on in 2012.
Right.
Democrats are able to bargain better because they don't care. Now Democrats say it about Republicans. I don't think it's true. I think these guys are, you know, cutthroat and just want to win. But the evil genius McConnell wants to undermine the economy, and that's why he doesn't want stimulus. I mean, I think that this deal shows that that's not there. I don't think McConnell thinks that unemployment benefits are going to stimulate the economy.
Right.
And I think I agree with Mitch McConnell on this.
Right.
And I think that they're politically, they just think they don't care about the unemployment benefits.
So, one other theory, I don't think you quite have to be an evil genius. You just have to be of evil and of above average intelligence.
Evil smart guy.
Yeah, evil, slightly better than average smart guy, which is, okay, so you don't think that, you don't buy the sort of Keynesian effects of these measures, but still, you know, we already see this, and I think we're going to continue to see this. The White House got what it wanted in just atmospherically. The American people saw Obama go in a room with the Republican leaders, hammer out a deal, do the American people's work, prevent their tax rates from going up, and I just think he's going to benefit much more than they are, right? Because he's the president. He's good. He's the governing party. He's the face of the governing party. He looked mature. He looked like an adult. He looked effective. He looked in control. And he came out with a deal. And I just think atmospherics just work so much better for him. I think the Republicans were right over the previous 2 years that obstruction helps them because it just sows frustration, and that frustration then just blows up in the face of the governing party. I would think that continued frustration, continued obstruction would be the way to go, not giving some, tangible deals to Obama.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you watch that press conference? If you think he came out looking composed and mature, he didn't. I think that he could have. He could have held a different press conference after the same exact deal and handled it well. But as far as I'm going to use your question as a segue to the other thing I want to talk about, will this help Obama? the question you have to ask next is, how pissed off is the left, right, and will that matter? So why don't you start on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think there was this weird moment. It was like the coyote running off the cliff before he discovered that it wasn't, you know, land underneath him, where the left was like, okay, you know, can we swear on this program? Maybe I won't. You know, it was okay.
My mom watched
it.
So
we were all ready to just, like, completely crucify the White House. But then, you know, they gave us this little bit of stimulus that we wanted, the unemployment benefits and the credits. And then they were like, okay, are we still mad? And there was just this, like, suspended state of animation. And they were like, we are really mad. And then they started dropping, you know. But there was this weird moment where people were sort of deciding, like, we were all ready to just completely lay into him for a total capitulation. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it was not a total capitulation. I mean, depending on who you talk, it was a defeat, yeah, but it was not a total mm-hmm. capitulation. And there was this weird, like, and then I think, you know, they decided that it was a real sellout. And I think, I think the thing that probably sealed it was the estate tax, which there's just enormous frustration over, even mm-hmm. more than the income tax hikes, because that was, you know, John Kyle got to basically dictate the terms of that exactly. So I think there's a lot of frustration. I think you're right. I think that's going to continue to be a problem for Obama all the way through 2012. I mean, the thing you have to understand about this is it was building for a while. The tax cut thing was both substantively and symbolically important. I think unlike, say, the public option, which kind of was fetishized and had a sort of totemic quality to it, even though most people never really thought that it was going to happen, I think this has both substantive and symbolic importance, so that kind of increased mm-hmm. the tension, you know, the bitterness.
But there's not going to be a realistic primary challenge to Obama.
No, there is not. I mean, the question is, look, you know, I mean, to me, the biggest danger that they have, and I wrote about a bit in my piece, is there is, and this goes a bit to your point about both sides imagining the other side as all powerful, but there is already a GOP infrastructure in place left over from the midterms, the Rove groups, American Crossroads, mm-hmm. GPS. They, in order to, you know, defend their 501c4, their nonprofit, their status, they have to spend a lot of money next year. And the thinking is they're going to spend it basically just talking down the economy. So they have to spend it on not overtly political things the way they did in the fall, but on just kind of general issue advocacy. And the thinking is that they're going to spend tens of millions, if not, you know, 100 or 200 million, just, you know, talking down the economy and kind of making the case the economy is pretty lousy, which it is, you know, so it's not, mm-hmm. it's not a stretch. You're beginning to see an infrastructure on the right that I think is going to be fairly effective and is going to be a real challenge for the administration. The place that you would hope would push back against this is the left, and that you would get a kind of an offsetting response. And you saw some of that during the midterms. I mean, some of the unions did turnout operations and some messaging that was helpful. If you don't have those guys pushing back, I think that's actually a substantial hit. Before you even get to kind of turnout and organizing for 2012, I think you need those guys excited and you need them on board and eager to kind of play their part. Just in 2011, where I think there's going to be a lot of kind of battles for perception of the economy, independent of the fundamentals and what Obama has done for it. So I think just 2011 alone is a place where you're going to want to see an energized left if you're the White House, because there's going to be a pretty big apparatus on the right that's coming after you.
I just think that I don't think it's going to cost Obama politically. There will be, I think that no matter what, there is going to be some dampened enthusiasm, and that there are things he could have done to stoke liberal enthusiasm more. I mean, if he was willing to, you know, pick a fight with Republicans over Guantanamo or stuff like that, he could have really rallied the base. Who knows at what cost towards the center. He's not stoking the base.
Right.
But I think that for good reason, the left is more willing to compromise and sort of get and stand by their man for these sort of compromises than the right is. I think mm-hmm. the right understands
I think that's right.
that I think conservatives see, well, if every time that we only get half of a loaf, we end up losing. And that incrementalism, what did Obama say the other day? He said, look, we started off Social Security as being a small thing, and it grew, and it's huge.
Right.
And we're all there, all the libertarians and conservatives say, yes, exactly, this was our argument against Obamacare. But for the left, incrementalism works a little bit.
I totally agree with you about Obamacare. I think that the left misses out and the right gets it. I think that is the logic of the health care plan,
And the incrementalism, and when you – so you see – and so I see – I love I read a lot of the liberals, and you see Glenn Greenwald and Jane Hampshire, you know, lose their cool over a lot of this. And then you see the Ezra Klein's and the Matt Iglesias saying, chill, this isn't what we wanted, but this is better than I expected, which first surprised me. I think it's funny because on the right it's always – so it's always the younger guys who are grabbing the pitchforks, and the old guys are compromising.
Right, that's right. On the left, the old guys have been radicalized over the last 10 years, and the younger guys sort of, you know.
But so that incrementalism works better for the left than it does for conservatives and libertarians.
I
don't think it's going to be a big deal.
I think that's a great point. I agree with you on the healthcare plan in particular. I mean, I think, you know, look, once you get people on exchanges and you get – I think the natural logic of this –
you get these medical loss ratio rules.
I think the natural logic of this is, at the very least, to undermine the employer-based system and get everybody on exchanges, at which point they get subsidies, and then the government, you know, can – you know, you could see a public option later on, you know, developing. You know, I mean, it's just – you know, basically, look, if I lose my job and I go and I get health care through the exchange – I'm probably not, you know, there's a good chance I'm not going to go back on to employee healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's almost like a Roach Motel kind of thing. Like, people check into the exchange, but they're not going to check out. And every time you're just
To think of Obamacare as being a Roach Motel.
I'm sure they'll love that too.
I
agree with you kind of about the inexorable logic of this. I also think that, you know, the people close to the White House made this point to me, and it sort of dovetails with your point about the left, and I think it's true. I mean, there were a lot of people who voted for Obama who were just sort of, kind of not politico types, but just kind of personally into the guy. It was very tough to get those people in 2010 to turn out. I mean, they were Obama people. They weren't Democrat, you know, Democratic partisans. They tried in a variety of ways to excite those people, and they just, you know, as long as Obama wasn't on the ballot, it was really tough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so just a certain number of those people are just going to show up in 2012, you know? I mean, it's a basic point, but it's in a sort of true about politics, but it's really tough to get the kind of Obama people, not the partisan Democrats, to turn out in a midterm. And some of those people are, are liberals. I mean, they have a liberal worldview, but they're Obama fans. You know, they're not kind of Democratic fans. And so I just think there will be a certain kind of, you know, I don't want to say automatic, but a certain uptick that he's going to get. From his base, not necessarily the party's base, that's going to help him a lot in 2012. So I agree with you. I mean, you can definitely overstate the problems that he has on the left.
Yeah. And just a final point on the Obama thing. I mean, this is why it's not crazy on the Obamacare thing, not the Obama thing. There's a lot of Obama things.
Right.
This is why it's not crazy for conservatives to talk about socialism. I mean, first of all, what's crazy is if they say, well, there was no socialism under Bush and there's socialism under Obama. Clearly, that's not true. But socialism doesn't mean, you know, we think this is Pol Pot or we think this is Stalin. It means that increasingly the government is gaining control over the economy. And that also means we think the government is gaining control over our lives. And when we look at – I look at the Medicare, Medicaid – smoking tobacco settlement stuff, where they said, look, the states were paying for the health care of sick people. So tobacco companies were imposing costs, and that's the basis of that lawsuit. And then you take it a step further and you say, if you are getting subsidized health care that I'm paying for, which increasingly now Americans will be, and not just special classes, not just the poor, and not just the elderly, every donut you eat, Noam, you're externalizing some of the costs to me. So that opens a door for more regulation over personal activity, not to mention how the medical loss ratio rules, how the exchanges create a sort of Trojan horse by which government can then come in and more micromanage insurance companies and then call the shots more for the research, for instance, that drug companies are doing. And so, I mean, there was even, wasn't it the CBO or somebody said, well, I don't know if you can even count insurance companies as private companies anymore with these medical loss ratio rules and all these regulations. So the sort of incrementalism, the way in which we see government programs grow and grow and act as this ratchet, we never get to turn them back, and their very existence justifies a new government intervention. Mm. When we see that, that's why we're crying socialism and we're crying stop, is because we don't want the government controlling the whole economy and controlling our lives. And it seems like a one-way road and all these Trojan horses and these ratchets, to use three different metaphors.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of thoughts. I mean, as I said, I agree with you about the logic of some of these programs, but, you know, which is to get more secure and larger over time. But, you know, it's as far, I stop short, you know, I get off somewhere before socialism, I guess I get off the boat. And in the same way, I would say, you know, every step you take off the ground, whether you're jumping or climbing a ladder, you know, or in an airplane or whatever, is theoretically a step toward the moon, but I'm not worried about ending up at the moon, you know.
But there's gravity. There's gravity. There's not gravity in government. When the maybe we destroyed, like, the Interstate Commerce Commission or something. There's one government program that basically we've ever gotten rid of.
Right,
the rest
right,
all
right.
get bigger, and they get bigger faster than we think. And,
right.
And so...
Well, look. The second point I would make is, and my colleague Don Chait has written about this. I think it's the right point. I think conservatives make the mistake of extrapolating from themselves and grafting their own view of the logic of these things onto liberals. And by that I mean, conservatives believe that less government is good in and of itself, and they think whatever you do to decrease government is sort of morally and substantively a good thing. Liberals do not think that, like, just increasing government is a good thing in and of itself. They think that, like, you know, lower income inequality is a good thing, and, yeah. you know, growth and having health care and less volatile income. There are a bunch of goals that they have, but they don't have views that are precisely analogous or symmetric to conservatives that say more government is a good thing, and anything we can do to expand it is just in principle good. And I think that's the kind of logical fallacy, and that is the gravity, you know, because at a certain point, you know, a complete government control of the economy, the means of production, would be bad. It would be self-defeating. And that acts as, you know, it does act as a check. And because liberals do have these goals that are independent of the government's role in the economy. So I just think there's a bit of a logical fallacy there that conservatives make because of their own views on this stuff.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. And it's something I've actually been thinking about, is the lack of parallelness. I want to correct, and, you know, there are all sorts of libertarians, all sorts of conservatives. But for me, at least, and I think this applies to a lot of conservatives, it's not that, and this is only sort of a semantic correction of what you said. It's not that we think less government is in and of itself a good thing, but that within the political realm, our goal is to decrease government. Because, I'm a Catholic, because I think that the things that are good and in and of themselves... Right. Involve human liberty, and so it's still a means to an end, but on the political scale, yeah, basically it is the end in itself.
Right, that's right. And more free, people would say more freedom is the end,
yes.
right? Is in principle
yes.
good. So it's kind of the flip side of it. Yeah.
But the conspiracy theory that dwells in all our minds, and that I don't think is crazy. I'll call it a conspiracy theory, but I still think
even paranoids have enemies, right?
Yes. Is that there are that politicians and bureaucrats often do want sort of power in and of itself, and that sometimes they will do things to get more power. I don't think the New Republic is necessarily doing things out of some fetish for the government having more power, but
and we
sometimes,
prefer that
you know,
continue
Chuck Schumer, like. He could make a lot of money, and he's not doing. Rahm Emanuel, he made $16 million in 2.5 years, and he didn't do that. Why are these people doing this? Why are they giving up? Why aren't they doing what Trent Lott and John Breaux are doing, which is monetizing their public service and just getting filthy rich? And sometimes I suspect it's because some people just want more government power. And there are Republicans like this, too. Usually foreign policy is their main focus. You look at a John Bolton or somebody like that, you think, do they just want more power for themselves? And so that's sometimes where we think, where some people just always want more money, there are people who just want more power over others. And sometimes these people want to be bosses in companies, and sometimes these people want to be bureaucrats or politicians in government.
It's true. Though I guess I happen to think that people are kind of complex and multifaceted, sure, and their motivations are layered. They both want more power, and they want to bring out X or Y. And it's tough to sort of make.
But I think it's notable that the government almost never says the way to solve this new problem has arisen, or this problem has come to light. The way to solve it is to get the government out of the way.
It's true, though, the government just this week, is selling off shares of Citigroup. It sold off shares of GM. I mean, the footprint in the financial world and the industrial world is shrinking very rapidly. A lot of conservatives and libertarians held that up as it wasn't just a step. It was like a major thoroughfare on the road to serfdom, So
the financial reform never Obama. Often, I think he framed the main point here as to prevent a crisis that would put us in a position where we had to do another bailout. Now, there were ways to try to move in that direction that involved decreasing the government's role in Wall Street, getting rid of some of the getting rid of some of the implicit bailouts. That if there wasn't fear of a bailout, if there wasn't the promise of a bailout, I should say, then these financial institutions wouldn't make themselves as interconnected and as willing to take on risks.
Right.
And so there were ways that involved less government that would do it. Or there are ways that even not sort of limited government programs, but that didn't create new bureaucracies, such as breaking up the big banks. I agreed with the liberals, of the liberals, to say, we should have broken up the big banks. It's this blunt thing that then there's no regulator getting in there, but it's just a blunt thing capping the size of the bank. But that wouldn't have given any bureaucrats, any politicians, more leverage over banks.
Right. I have long, complicated views on financial reform. The short story is I don't disagree with what you're saying. That would have been my first choice solution too. I don't think that was so much because the government just wanted to continue, or the Obama people wanted to continue to exert control over the economy. It was just the political path of least resistance there. Yeah.
Isn't this another great segue to your piece from last week?
Your thoughts about Obama and business and kind of where the business community stands and where Obama stands vis-a-vis the business community.
Yeah, I've always thought it was a silly – this is almost quoting your piece, and I'll start with the thing I agree on. I always thought it was a silly thing to do to say President Obama is anti-business. Piece I'm talking about specifically is – Noam Scheiber's Obama's Hold on Big Business, December 2nd on The New Republic. Obama's not that he's anti-business was a silly idea. I think that it is noteworthy that he didn't have people with real private sector experience. I don't think he gets business. I think that he is, especially compared to Bush and even to Clinton, he is anti-free market. But as you point out in the piece, yes, he bailed out GM. He did cash for clunkers. He did the stimulus, which the Chamber of Commerce was hugely supportive of. He supported the Wall Street bailout, and even more than he has to, he's standing up for and sort of owning the Wall Street bailout to the point where, because of his rhetoric, I think most people are forgetting that this was a Bush-Paulson thing and not just a Bernanke-Obama thing. And so he's not anti-business. I think that, and this is my shtick, but I think that he believes in a robust business-government cooperation that I call corporatism, that I think is very destructive. What I think about where a lot of liberals miss a point, and I think your column doesn't go into this nuance enough, your piece, is the Chamber of Commerce is not synonymous with business. The chamber, almost every candidate they supported with ads was a Republican. There were exceptions, but they were almost all Republican.
Right.
But if you look at political action committee spending, business PACs in the most politically active industries all favored the Democrats in 2010. And so one of the reasons that the Chamber of Commerce, they are good, from my point of view, on regulation, is that regulation often picks winners and losers. And the Chamber, even if it's a little heavily tilted towards big business, has to represent the whole industry. So that's why they end up being sort of pro-bailout, pro-handout, but then anti-cap-and-trade, anti-healthcare reform.
Right.
While smaller businesses, while you get a Pfizer coming in, or basically the whole drug industry, and supporting the healthcare reform that the chamber opposed.
Right.
You get the hedge funds coming in, basically supporting the Wall Street thing that most of the actual banks and the chamber opposed. So that's just a little nuance I want to
throw in. I have to say, the chamber on financial reform, I mean, my sense, and I did some reporting on this, the big banks were overwhelmingly driving for example, on derivatives regulation, you have this huge end-user campaign, right, where the people who buy the derivative, you know, who are trying to hedge risk, basically using derivatives to hedge risk, said that, you know, if these things go on exchanges and we're forced to clear them, which means basically it's complicated, but having them sufficiently collateralized, that we don't want that because our price is going to go up. When, in fact, that wasn't really true. The big banks didn't want that because when these things don't trade on exchanges, their margins are much larger. And I think they were able to use the chamber to drive their agenda on that and keeping these things out of clearing and out of exchanges, when in fact I think that would have benefited most of the chambers, some of their industrial customers and really actually the smaller companies, I mean, big enough to use derivatives to hedge risk, but not big enough to drive a hard bargain with a JP Morgan or a Goldman Sachs. So I actually think on financial reform in particular, the chamber, and certainly the derivatives piece, the chamber really did was kind of driven by the big banks there. I agree with you that there is some gravitational pull that small businesses exert, but there is also, if you talk to some of the small business members of the chamber, they are constantly frustrated that the big guys kind of set the agenda.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I think that as far as going forward, you raise the important points, again, back to the distinction among the Republican Party. Are we talking about the Lisa Murkowski's and the to some extent Mitch McConnell and the House Appropriators and Dave Camp, who's the incoming chairman of the Ways and Means Committee? These guys I'd put more in the establishment wing. I sometimes call them the K Street wing.
Right.
Or are we talking about Mike Lee, who could, you know, new senator-elect from Utah, who could filibuster a debt ceiling hike.
Right.
And so obviously the chamber's sweet spot is right of center, but it includes the Mary Landrews, the late Blanche Lincoln.
Right.
It includes the conservative Democrats and sort of the right 50-60%. I mean, the real sweet spot would be the right 30% of the left 30% of the Republican Party and the right 10% of the Democratic Party. That the conservatives, which is not synonymous with Tea Party stuff, but in general it is. The conservatives are going to, by opposing bailouts, by opposing stimulus, by opposing cash for clunkers, by opposing all these green subsidies that the chamber scores on, they're not in the business sweet spot. And this is one of the... I make this point again and again, but because the media so often gets it wrong.
Yep.
You look at the chamber scorecard. Their least favorite two Republicans in the Chamber of Commerce scorecard were Jim DeMint and Tom Coburn. And on the House side, it was Jeff Flake and Ron Paul. You don't get more free market than those
four. I agree. Yeah, I agree. And that's why I think, I mean, this was kind of one of the thrusts of my piece. I think the chamber people are having real buyer's remorse, you know. I mean, they said some actually encouraging things about the Tea Party during the campaign. They put some money behind those candidates, and I don't know that they're getting their money's worth out of this. I mean,
I think Sorry, go on.
Well, you know, I mean, look, clearly there are certain things that they obviously saw out on, and, you know, upper income tax cuts and some of the regulatory stuff they clearly want to roll back. But I think they have real anxieties about the Fed fight, for example. I mean, that's, you know, they very much want an active Federal Reserve, you know, supplying liquidity to the economy and being there as, you know, using its balance sheet when things get dicey. You know, and they're very worried about a Ron Paul, you know, heading the whatever the subcommittee is on the House version of the banking committee.
Monetary policy.
So, you know, I think they have second thoughts there. As you say, I mean, there are a bunch of, you know, infrastructure is something they like. They like subsidy, green energy subsidies. I mean, I think they didn't entirely think through. I think that what they thought about the Tea Party was, and you saw this a lot during the campaign, was, yeah, Tea Party, you know, there's a lot of energy, but a lot of these guys who are running as quote-unquote Tea Party candidates actually have political experience, and they've been in state legislatures, and they're pragmatists, and, you know, when they get to Capitol Hill, they realize there are certain crazy things they can't do. I think that was actually just kind of a logical mistake, because it's not about individual congressmen or senators and individual legislators. It's the movement itself, and I alluded to this earlier, the movement itself has a huge gravitational pull on the party, because everyone from, you know, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins to even relatively conservative people who just aren't quite Tea Party people, mm-hmm. Has to think of a primary challenge, you know, the next time they run. So they can't tell the Tea Party people, look, this fight you're picking on the debt limit or the Fed is nuts, because they're going to have to answer those people, you know, answer those people or a potential challenger the next time they're up. So I think the idea that somehow power would be moderating for the individual people that were elected kind of on the Tea Party plank, I think that was just kind of a fairly simplistic way of looking at where the power comes from with respect to the Tea Party. And it comes not from individual politicians, but just always this potential of a primary, always this potential of getting mau-mau'd from the grassroots that exists and isn't really going away.
Well, and you're making me hopeful. You actually convinced me more now than you did in your piece that the Tea Party can pull some levers. Couple things.
Yeah, I mean, look, Dick Lugar and Olympia Snowe are going to have, like, primary challenge.
Orrin Hatch is going to do everything he can to prevent one, to ward one off. And so that's why you're right.
Right.
And you know, Rob Portman and Dan Coats are sitting right there grateful that they had their primaries as early as they did, and Mark Kirk. But what you've got is where I think you're sort of, again, doing a little too much assignment of power to the Chamber of Commerce. They didn't want Marco Rubio. They didn't want Rand Paul. They didn't want Mike Lee. They didn't want, in the candidates who lost, they didn't want Ken Buck and Joe Miller and Sharon Angle. All the political action committees and the Chamber of Commerce. You often had, my favorite primaries were the Chamber of Commerce versus Club for Growth. Because, again, I mean, they all look alike to a lot of the liberals. The Chamber of Commerce versus Club for Growth primaries, you had a lot of those. And so they often lost. And so that they did end up cutting ads in the general election for some of these Tea Party things was part of the effort to, as Trent Mott says, co-opt these people. And how much can you co-opt and how much do you have to give? Because co-opting isn't free, right? So, Mitch McConnell went along with the earmark ban, which maybe it is basically free because it's not enforceable. But what else are they going to have to do in order to make these Tea Party guys, as Rob Portman and you both say, behave like adults, be serious legislators? And so that's a fun question. And to the degree that Tom Donahue is worried about these Republicans, I am thrilled, and
you're
to the degree that
you're
instilling in me confidence that what you might get is some pitchfork waving, you know, free market populists on Capitol Hill, I'm also excited. To the degree that I'm a conservative, I'm not very hopeful that I'll get anything that I want.
Right. Well, I think that's a good place to stop. We can both toast Tom Donahue's indigestion. I think that's a good parting thought for us.
Well, cheers. Thank you, Noam.
Terrific. Enjoyed it.
Bye.
All right. Take care.